Holiday magic is in the air at iFly Indoor Skydiving. Imagine unwrapping the experience of flight. iFly is the perfect unique gift for anyone who wants to turn their dream of flying into a joyful reality. It's unforgettable fun for all ages. Save over 35% with iFly's limited-time holiday gift voucher flight packages. Turn dreams into unforgettable moments with the gift of flight. Go to iFlyWorld.com to purchase your holiday gift vouchers. That's iFlyWorld.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome, listener. For this episode, we cover the players, those involved. It's an older story, with its murder taking place in 1924. At the time, it was called the crime of the century, with a trial the likes the world had never seen. A full-blown media spectacle. This is the story of Leopold and Loeb, the perfect crime, and the victim caught up in a senseless scheme. As a word of warning, the story sometimes jumps from seemingly simple retelling of a crime to exploring the dark thoughts of those involved. Because of this, there may be some points at which disturbing content comes seemingly from nowhere, but I'll let you know in advance, there's no animal harm. If you are easily upset by descriptions of violence or sexual assaults, this episode may not be for you. Now, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Adventures of Richard Loeb. Richard Loeb was born on June 11, 1905, in Chicago, Illinois, the third of three brothers, his father a lawyer and a senior executive at Sears. Papa Loeb kept busy at work, hired a governess named Emily to help raise and educate his son, Richard. Emily is a Canadian transplant. She quickly became more than daycare. Emily became another member of the family. She never struck Richard, but she was very, very strict. At a young age, whatever Emily gave Richard to read, he consumed with a fervent passion. But what he really wanted to read, what his true passion was for crime and mystery novels. Emily, known for being generally uptight about what someone chooses to do with their leisurely time, would never have allowed for Richard to read these books. She saw them as pulp, brain rot. But on one fateful day, Richard happened onto a copy of Frank Packard's mystery novel, The Beloved Traitor. After The Beloved Traitor, Richard needed to satiate his new obsession, so Richard sought out further Packard novels. This is when he came upon Packard's The Adventures of Jimmy Dale. The book centered on a criminal and rich playboy named Jimmy Dale, who planned elaborate heists. Jimmy Dale wouldn't steal anything. It was all for the thrill. The influence this had on Richard Loeb ran deep. After Frank Packard, Richard graduated to the likes of Arthur Conan Doyle, Jules Verne, and Maurice LeBlanc. In October 1917, Richard was a high school student freshman. He skipped several grades due to his high intelligence. His older brother, Ernest, was a senior and the captain of the soccer team. This helped Richard acclimate to being among older students. Richard soon found himself in the Freshman Literary Society. It was there that he was able to show off his literary prowess. He reveled in showing up other students and was crushed when he lost a close election for president of the society. Even though he lost the election, Richard quickly became one of the most popular freshmen. 1917 was a different time. Good grades were met with adulation from his peers, and he received only the highest marks. At the end of a successful freshman year, Richard and his class celebrated with cake, ice cream, and a non-alcoholic beer called Bevo that was popular at the time. Bevo would see a surge in sales with Prohibition just around the corner, but the celebration wouldn't last. As stated before, Emily could be strict, and frankly, that was an understatement. She expected the best from Richard, even if he was among the elite of his school. When other boys were out playing, Richard Loeb would be indoors studying his books. When not reading directly from the source material, Emily would quiz him on what he had read. Because of this strict lifestyle, Richard continued to outdo those around him in his studies. He was 12 when he became a high school freshman. By 13, he was enrolled in the University of Chicago. Richard's father was rarely present in his life during this period. As president of Sears, he just didn't have free time to spare. It is around this time Richard recalls forming the habit of lying to get his way. It was his method of maintaining some level of control in his life. At 14, Richard found himself in a university, and the course load was almost too much. He initially joined the Literary Society, but had to drop out because he just had too much homework. Emily had signed him up for as many classes per semester the school would allow him to take. Emily and Richard would sit up late into the night, studying his classes. Richard had to forego simple comforts like a social life or getting a reasonable amount of sleep. On June 19th, at only 15 years old, Richard Loeb graduated from university. Emily saw this as a shared accomplishment. By this point, something dark was growing in Richard's heart. He hated Emily for dictating every waking hour of his life, felt resentment for his parents because they weren't a part of his life, and an all-consuming jealousy of his fellow students festered in his core. It burned at Richard's ability to reason, who sometimes found himself overcome with dark thoughts. Most of his fellow students were 4 to 5 years older than him. There was no one to help unpack these type of feelings. Sure, he was popular in school, but when it came to stuff like this, Richard felt alone. After graduation, Emily was caught in error. For all of her ambition, she never considered it was the quality of an education that mattered, not the speed. Emily had rushed Richard from one grade to the next, and his father finally caught on. Richard, who could have, no, should have, been one of the brightest students at the university, had received B's and C's. He had been forced to compact years of an education into a single year. Emily was released from her role as Richard's caretaker that same year, 1920 to be exact. It was a mixed blessing because, on one hand, Richard was finally given personal freedom, and on the other hand, because, well, Richard had finally been given personal freedom. Looking back, Richard admits that this was when things made a turn for the worse. June 1920 marked the year Richard Loeb first met Nathan Leopold. Part 2. Friendship. Nathan Leopold was born on November 19th, 1904, in Chicago, Illinois. Leopold was born into a well-respected and wealthy family. Like Richard, he was highly intelligent at a young age, but unlike Richard, he wasn't popular. In fact, he was relentlessly bullied. It seemed the other students could sense his weakness right away. He had been shy, unwilling to join in on sports, and when students found out that Nathan had once attended a school for girls, it didn't help matters. Nathan also had a governess that replaced the role that should have been held by his parents. Matilda once was an eccentric woman with a German accent. Her presence in any room was undeniable, and she was quick to make herself the center of any conversation. To the rest of the help in the household, there was an open secret. Something more than just flirtation in Matilda's manner. As with many of the killers we've covered, Nathan, at the hands of Matilda, was the unfortunate victim of sexual abuse. In my research, I have come across sources that almost dismiss this as a negative impact. They mention the fact that Nathan looked back fondly at his governess. Well, I'm going to call it for what it was. Nathan was raped starting at the age of 12 by a woman far into her 30s. Listener, this should go without saying, but a 12-year-old cannot consent. That's just rape. By 15 years old, Nathan skipped his senior year of high school and went to college. In 1923, Richard Loeb and Nathan met in the University of Chicago. Richard had chosen to study American constitutional history. In his previous years, he had grown fond of history, so the class seemed like a nice fit. Leopold and Loeb made an interesting duo. Richard excelled in social situations. He carried an ease and confidence that naturally radiated from his person. From years of being in school with people older than him and having to fit in, Nathan, on the other hand, was anxious at best and arrogant at worst. Nathan was the stern, bookish type. This made him a less than sympathetic character in social circles. It's difficult to understand what the two saw in each other. Richard spent nights out drinking and picking up girls. Nathan spent nights locked away in solitude with his books. But on campus, Richard was known to break away from social circles to provide companionship to Nathan. And despite his naturally poisonous disposition, Nathan was happy to return the favor. It seemed the two had found a certain bond. You see, because for Richard, all that girl chasing he was doing, it was part of a show. Something he had to do to fit in. He didn't even necessarily like girls, or boys for that matter. Listener, have you ever had that kind of friendship? One in which there isn't much in the way of common ground, yet a sort of soul bond, indescribable, but pure. It goes beyond that, though. The feelings were there, and it wasn't long before Nathan found that he was deeply in love with Richard. Richard began a pattern of scheming and bringing Nathan along with him. Nathan, helplessly in love, couldn't say no. It started with cheating in cards, graduated to smashing windows, then soon escalated to stealing cars. Nathan found that his mother's car key would fit in other cars of the same brand. Seems like a security issue. This led to a string of car thefts in which the pair were never caught. Once another driver spotted the theft and a chase ensued, Richard and Nathan narrowly escaped. They never felt more alive. And this wasn't for the money, listener. They both came from impossibly wealthy families and were both given near bottomless allowances. Richard was a thrill seeker, and his thrill was crime. The part that he loved, almost more than committing the criminal act itself, was creating the perfect plan. He took great pleasure at being one step ahead of the world. He fancied himself as Jimmy Dale in those mystery adventure stories he'd read all those years ago. There was a fantasy that Richard became obsessed with. He imagined, after a lifetime of committing hundreds, no thousands of crimes, that he would finally be caught. Maybe from weariness or an old age, maybe from losing the sense of the thrill. Whatever the case, listener, he imagined his arrest drawing a huge crowd of people. Richard imagined himself in front of the crowd, whipped and beaten by his jailers. During this beating, he imagined the crowd watched, awestruck and filled with pity. And as the whipping continued, something changed in the crowd. They began to chant Richard's name. Nathan fed into this narcissism. Everything Richard came up with was proclaimed brilliant by his partner in crime. Nathan was neutral on the effects of crime. He didn't feel good about any of the acts they committed, but he didn't feel bad either. They were a means to an end for Nathan, a way to get closer to Richard. Nathan had fantasies of his own. He saw himself as a slave, Richard his guardian. Nathan sometimes imagined himself living under Richard's bed, a sort of perverse pet that lived solely to pleasure Richard. This fantasy often ran through his mind when Richard concocted his schemes. He saw these ideas as commands, and Nathan carried them out as a dutiful slave. Nathan was totally submissive to him in ways that Richard himself didn't immediately realize. By 1923, the pair graduated. Richard coasted along, just slipping through the cracks. Nathan was the ideal student, top of his class. Nathan had even become a published author on bird migration. Richard began giving Nathan sexual favors. Richard himself was an asexual. He looked at sex with an indifference. Richard was far more interested in thrill-seeking. So with Nathan helping Richard carry out his desires, Richard decided to do the same for his friend. Richard didn't see himself as gay or homosexual, but he cared deeply about Nathan. That was enough for him. During this time, Nathan became obsessed with Friedrich Nietzsche. He saw himself and Richard as supermen who operated outside of the law. He was convinced that their intellectual and financial privilege should grant them the ability to operate outside of the law. In Nathan's mind, the only thing that should matter to a superman was acting on one's desires. Nathan began to reject humanity and its laws. He felt that the world was carried on the backs of the superior. This concept bothered him a great deal. It bothered him that, in his mind at least, intellectuals like Richard were forced to carry such weight. In all of Nathan's tiring, endless rants, one word stuck out to Richard: murder. Could they get away with it? It wasn't about the murder itself. It was about getting away with the ultimate crime. Maybe there could be a ransom. There was often a ransom in stories Richard had read, but that would cause an extra layer of difficulty. Richard spent days wrestling with these thoughts. Slowly, the conclusion of this thought process began to lock into place. Richard was a full-blown narcissist with a thrill-seeking mentality. The escalation process had ceased to being gradual, and each act seemed more extreme. Someone was going to be their victim, but who? Before committing the murder, Leopold and Loeb decided that the pair needed a test, a new escalation, something that would prove to themselves that they would be capable of committing any crime, no matter how dangerous. Part 3. The Typewriter Bandits.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
You know, listener, finances is a subject that I know some people like to avoid, but coming off of a large move myself, in which I spent in the neighborhood of $7,000 to $10,000 to move cross-state, finances have been on my mind ever since. My wife and I, we've hit a point where we've realized it's time to make some serious money moves, to take control of my finances by using a Chime checking account with features like no maintenance fees, fee-free overdraft up to $200, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. And hey, let me tell you, we've all experienced overdraft before. Chime has overdraft protection, with Chime allowing you to overdraft up to $200 with no fees. Get spotted on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. No money fees or maintenance fees. Over 50,000 fee-free ATMs. To date, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Make your fall finances a little greener by working towards your financial goals with Chime. Open your account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank, N.A. or Stride Bank, N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in Spot Me and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details. November 10th, 1923, 3 a.m. Just hours before, a football game between Michigan and Ohio State was attended by so many students, the ground shook beneath your feet. After the game, a massive party was held at the Zeta Beta Tau fraternity. Prohibition was broken. The students drank large quantities of alcohol. The party didn't finish until after midnight. So late into the night, Richard and Nathan snuck into the fraternity, flashlights in hand. This had been Richard's fraternity, and he looked around the entrance with a nostalgic feeling. How did it already feel like it had been so long? Would life be this way? A constant consideration of the past, measuring one's time until the hourglass ran empty. The fraternity building, a three-story mansion that had a winding path, revealed a mess inside, including leftovers from the party, remnants from smoking, drinking, and eating, garments strewn about. A big celebratory football banner had been knocked askew and now hung straight down from one end. How someone got up there was a mystery not worth solving. Leopold and Loeb had other pressing matters. There was no noise, and the silence was unnerving. The two pressed through the mansion at a careful crawl. One misstep could lead to arrest and a permanent blemish on their record. At one point, the floor creaked and the two stood still for what felt like an eternity. Again, nothing moved. The two continued. They happened upon a large quantity of clothes and took the wallets they found inside. In the wallets, they found a total of $70. Adjusted for inflation, that's over $1,000. Not a bad score. The two also grabbed some loose items found around the house, some pens, watches, and other assorted goods. Then they saw it. The big ticket item, a brand new Hammond typewriter. In 1923, a typewriter as quality as a Hammond was worth as much as a car. The two hauled the typewriter out to their vehicle. It was a two-person job, as the typewriter was both awkward to hold and heavy. The floorboards creaked as they went downstairs, but by now, the two felt confident. They all but slammed the door shut on their way out. On the road, Leopold and Loeb couldn't stop laughing. They shared from a bottle of gin, and as time passed, they found themselves adequately tipsy. Even without the booze, the two were high on their success. But as they crossed into Chicago, and the alcohol and thrill wore off, the mood began to shift. Richard and Nathan sat in contemplative silence. Financially, the two had everything they ever wanted, so the items in the car were basically of no use to them. Richard tried to speak up and lighten the mood, but Nathan was obviously irritated and cut off any conversation with a short response. After insisting that they park, Richard then demanded that they talk. Nathan, whether this was an initial issue or not, complained that Richard wouldn't have sex with him anymore, that as the thrills they saw increased in danger, Richard wasn't holding up his end of friendship. After hearing Nathan's lament, Richard took a moment to think it over. He admitted to Nathan that he would never become prone to initiate the sexual favors, as it wasn't Richard's desire. So the two would need to come to an agreement, an exchange of sorts. Richard would agree to a specific number of sexual favors for each criminal act the two committed. Nathan sat up. The calculated nature of this contract didn't faze him. After all, in Nathan's mind, Richard was his master, his king. The two shook on it. Back on the road, Richard was cheerful again. The two talked the whole ride back, Richard doing most of the talking, leaning on Nathan, chiding him about how noisy he was during the robbery. It was still dark, trees jutting against the backdrop of the skyline. It was moments like these the two friends chased, the shared empowerment of committing a crime, with no fear of getting caught. They were on a dark road, both literally and figuratively, and for better or worse, they were on it together. In the back of his mind, Richard had other plans. He needed Nathan in good spirits. The plan for murder was coming together in his mind. The robbery had proven that they were capable of taking things to that next level. Richard shifted the conversation to the plan. He stroked Nathan's ego on his knowledge and passion for Nietzsche. They needed to be Übermensch, Richard explained. Their knowledge was going to be a waste. The two, Richard elaborated, had an immunity to the law, an immunity that they were wasting. After all, tonight proved it. Naturally, it should be a child, Nathan pitched in. Richard agreed. Less variables that way, less likely to be capable of fighting back. And a girl, Nathan continued. Nathan had a secret fantasy of being the commanding officer of German soldiers. In this fantasy, he and the men took turns raping a little Jewish girl. He imagined commanding the soldiers to rip her clothes off. The rape would go on for so long that she would eventually die of exhaustion. Nathan told Richard that if they kidnapped a girl, that he wanted to take turns raping her, that they could kill her after. Richard put a stop to the fantasy before it could take hold. He explained that their first time needed to be perfect. There needed to be no chance that the two could get caught. Nathan was upset at first, clearly excited by the prospect of rape, but he agreed. Richard was his master after all. Richard realized he needed to put a stamp on this now. He knew that Nathan was capable of obsessing until he got his way. Looking out the car window, the sun had broken through the clouds. The sky had a purple hue. It will be a boy, Richard explained. He determined this because he wanted to assert full control of the plan. Part 4. The Game. Months passed by. Leopold and Loeb spent Christmas and New Year's with their respective families. Once the holidays ceased, the two continued their studies. Richard's plans pulled into focus. He and Nathan could lure a boy into their car. The boy would need to be rendered unconscious. In the stories, they always used chloroform. After the boy was out, they could take him to the Indiana state line. At the state line was a drainage pipe they could use to their advantage. It was 3 feet wide and ran underneath a nearby railroad. If they hid the body there, it would never be found. Who would think to check? Richard felt that both should commit the murder. If only one committed the crime, then one could sell the other out. There needed to be a way for the two to kill the boy at the same time. Richard decided that they could tie a rope around the boy's neck and then pull on both sides of the rope at the same time. That way, the blame could be shared. The image of two preppy affluenza-inflicted sociopaths playing tug-of-war with someone's neck is a strange thought. The question of ransom became an important one. $10,000 seemed like a good number, not because they needed the money, but because it was a respectable number. It was enough to have an impact, but not enough to seem childish. Richard and Nathan agreed to each be critical of the plan as it developed. It had to be airtight. If this was the start of their infamy, they couldn't get caught in their first important crime. Nathan was still sore about sexual assault being out of the question. He still brought it up, but never with any conviction. He figured that there could always be another murder, and by then, they would be more confident. To get the ransom money, the two decided it would be best to get the boy's father to throw a briefcase full of money from a train. The two rehearsed the throw, and it worked. Richard threw the money from the train, and Nathan retrieved it. The plan was coming together. This could work. Leopold and Loeb were ecstatic and celebrated together that night. The red sports car the pair drove, it couldn't work. It would stand out. It was memorable. Even if it wasn't red, Richard thought they shouldn't use their own vehicle. They needed to rent a vehicle. They needed false identities. With that idea, Nathan opened a checking account under the name Morton D. Ballard, under the address of Peoria, Illinois. He listed the occupation as traveling salesman. This effectively made him a drifter. Under the Ballard name, Nathan deposited $100 cash. The bank employee found the exchange strange. Nathan didn't exactly pass as a traveling salesman. He had wavy black hair and an upper-class swagger about him. There was also a seriousness about the salesman, a lack of charisma that didn't fit. a bookishness. He just didn't pass. But money was money, and the employee didn't have anything but a hunch to go on. At the same time, Richard Loeb checked into the Morrison Hotel with a suitcase under the name Morton D. Ballard. The suitcase carried 4 books. Richard didn't get a second glance. He had a way with people, and thinking about it now, maybe he should have opened the checking account. Richard told the reception he would be staying for the night. He informed the receptionist that he might receive mail, and Richard was on his way. The following Friday, Nathan arrived at the car rental business with $400. He again used the identity of Morton D. Ballard. He listed as a reference a Lewis Mason. Richard sat and waited at the payphone, as planned. When the rental company called the number, he was there to answer. "Yes, this is Lewis Mason," Richard answered after he picked up the phone. After the conversation was over, Richard could feel his skin tingling. All the pieces were falling into place. In his mind, this is almost better than committing murder itself. Almost. Back at the rental office, Nathan explained he would need the car in a few weeks. He asked the rental employee if he could mail the identification card to his address, and the employee agreed. Nathan wrote the address of the hotel visited by Richard earlier that day. Another piece fell into place. Leopold and Loeb spent a weekend near the location where they planned to grab their target. Richard watched students come and go from the Harvard school with dawning disappointment. They couldn't know who their target was going to be. The variables were too random. Whoever it was would have to be whoever worked out in the moment. While Richard was hunting for students, Nathan was hunting for birds. He wanted a sandpiper for his collection. After spotting some, he fired 3 shots with his gun but missed. As the birds flew away, he fired 2 more shots, but the gun jammed. The birds flew away, unharmed. On May 20th, 1924, the day before the murder, the two purchased a chisel to use as their weapon. After, they parted ways for a while. Richard purchased some stationery for the ransom, and Nathan went to a general store to buy some chocolate. The chocolate wasn't for the murder. Nathan was hungry and wanted to indulge. After finishing the chocolate, Nathan took a trip to the drugstore. There, he purchased a pint of hydrochloric acid. The drugstore clerk seemed a little concerned about the purchase at first. It was a large amount of acid, but Nathan explained he needed the acid for an experiment, and the clerk seemed satisfied. Nathan walked out with a large glass bottle that had a cork sealed with wax. The acid cost less than $1. Once Leopold and Loeb reunited at the end of the day, they had one piece of business left, the ransom letter. Richard suggested modeling the letter off a crime story he found in the newspaper. All of these years later, and he still had a childlike fascination with crime stories, taking them at face value, using them as the blueprint for real murder. Nathan couldn't see why not. Being the better writer of the two, Nathan sat in front of the typewriter. The pair stole what seemed like ages ago. He took his time. When it was finished, the pair marveled at the text. The writing was clean. No grammatical errors. The type of writing ability only the highly educated at the time could possess. And so, with the ransom letter finished, two highly privileged people, one with misplaced feelings of love, the other a narcissist, were set to commit a vicious and senseless murder. The game was on.
Holiday magic is in the air at iFly Indoor Skydiving. Imagine unwrapping the experience of flight. iFly is the perfect unique gift for anyone who wants to turn their dream of flying into a joyful reality. It's unforgettable fun for all ages. Save over 35% with iFly's limited-time holiday gift voucher flight packages. Turn dreams into unforgettable moments with the gift of flight. Go to iFlyWorld.com to purchase your holiday gift vouchers. That's iFlyWorld.com.